So this is volume 16, September 21, 1923. Jesus will show the generations how Louisa's fidelity was tested by 1, his love, 2, his cross, and 3, his divine will. Now the subject here is that people are going to be jealous of everything he has done for her, and he's wants us to know that it's all balanced by the terrible tests that she received. Okay. Louisa said, "I felt very embittered because of the privation of my sweet Jesus. Everything seemed to be over for me." She loves that expression. With almost no more hope that he would return to his little or poor exiled one. The extraordinary thing is that spiritually we have a very short memory. He was only been with her the day before. Do you know what I mean? But if you leave a child at home, a small child, to go down to the shops, the child thinks you're gone forever. And the child suffers dreadfully. Okay. Now, spiritually, Louisa is like that. And that's because she has had such extraordinary experience of God. "I felt my heart crack." We say our heart breaks, although I can't imagine one is better than the other. "I felt my heart crack with pain, thinking that I would not see again the one who, having lived life with me, formed my very life." So if he forms my very life, it's completely intolerable that he's not there in this felt way that she wants. "And now my life had disappeared and was separated from me." I explained this many times before. She's living a supernatural life. She's dependent on Jesus for the body, mind and spirit. She's not depending on food. She might get a little bit, but she's not actually depending on it. And so if he's not there in the way that she wants, that is, in my opinion, three-dimensional form. It's not quite that. If she can't see him and as we see each other, she feels that life just literally disappears from her. "My Jesus, how brutally you kill me," she said. "Without you, I feel the pains of hell, that while I die, I am actually forced to live," which is a correct description of hell. "Now, while I was in this state, so painful, my always beloved Jesus moved in my interior, and putting one arm, he'd clasped me to give me life again." Now, that's Song of Songs. And I think it's chapter 2, verse 5. I think it is. It could be around there. "His left hand is around me and his right arm supports me." Okay. "And he told me, 'My daughter, my will wanted to make justice of you.'" Because she is committed to divine justice. Saint Therese committed herself to divine mercy. "This was necessary in order to test your fidelity. And since all my attributes concur in all of my works." So if you experience love and mercy and kindness and wisdom and all the rest, you have to experience justice as well, because all the attributes of God are all equal. "And when the generations," that is the generations coming after Louisa, like us, "will see that I have all that I have poured into you, and amazed they will say, 'How could she not do all of this when he gave her so much?'" See, that's the temptation we would have. He has poured so many gifts and everything into her. Of course she loves him like this. "My justice will show the tests it made you undergo, and will say to them, 'I made her go through the fire of my justice and I found her faithful.'" Now, part of that fire is the privations, which absolutely kills her. And I've said this to you before, that if you ask a person what their cross is, they may actually give you the wrong answer. Louisa was prepared to be crucified, not just carry part of the cross, but the privations she couldn't tolerate. Now, your cross is what you would give to anybody, anywhere, anytime, under any condition, no questions asked. It's intolerable. That's what your actual cross is. But we call things crosses when we mean small little trials, actually. And so we're not speaking technically about the real thing. So "I made her go through the fire of my justice and I found her faithful. And this is why my love continued its course." My love, of course, God is love. And therefore, this whole journey is a journey into love. Even more, you must know that the first to make justice of you was my love. Now, as I'm reading this, remember the hours of the Passion, because Jesus said that the first to create the Passion in him was divine love, okay? And the second was reparation for us, and the third was the what Louisa calls the Jews. Is that okay? So the first is my love. How many tests did it not make you undergo in order to be sure about your love? Now, in any human relationship, people do make little tests to find out if the person is worthy to be lived with. Is that okay? We do test them. The second one was the cross, which made severe justice of you to the point that my will, drawn by my love and by my cross, wanted to descend into you and to make you live in the divine will. But my will also did not want to be outdone by my love and by the cross, and to be sure, jealous, it withdrew, making justice of you to see whether you would continue your flights in my will without me. So it's the divine will that's actually making her go through the privations. Do you love me because you see me? Do you love me because you're enjoying it? Or do you love me? Now, we all have this test in prayer, but on a much milder level. And that is, you know, in the early days when people are experiencing fervor in prayer and all the rest of it, they can pray because they enjoy it, but they don't realize they're praying because they enjoy it. So what the Lord does then is he withdraws a little and allows you to experience aridity in prayer, which means that prayer is very difficult. And he wants to see, will you pray when prayer is difficult? Because that's you showing love. And the example I often give to people is something that the Lord allowed to happen to me in order for me to be able to teach. And this is something I want to say to the teachers, and that is that if you're going to teach people, the Lord will allow you to have an experience that is absolutely necessary for you to explain something fundamental to somebody else. And this was the experience he got me to do. This is years ago. I was in my other house in Sallynoggin, and he told me to get up at 6 a.m., no problem. January, no problem. Don't put the heat on, problem. Don't cover yourself up in blankets and all the rest of it to keep yourself warm, problem. And now pray. You see, so I was frozen. And I'm one of these people that if the temperature goes down at all, I start sneezing and getting colds and all the rest of it. Anyway, so I sat there. He told me not to make myself comfortable, not to make myself warm, and not all the knots of what you would normally do. And so I sat there in front of the crucifix, and it was the longest hour I ever lived in my whole life. I must have looked at my watch about 10 times and in the end decided that the watch had stopped. I went out and discovered that the clock agreed with the watch, which was awful. At the end of that time, I was freezing cold. And I said to the Lord, I hope you got something out of this. I said, I'm cold and I'm bored. And it was one of the times when he actually spoke. And, you know, it's not always wonderful when he speaks. He said, this time it was all for me. And look how much love you had. When I'm giving to you and you're enjoying it, everything's fine. You'll spend the hour and you might spend two. But if I just withdraw the comforts and it's all sacrifice on your part, then you show me how much you love me. And I said to him, I obviously don't love you at all. And that's where you start, when you actually discover that love is sacrifice. Now, I could give you that in much greater detail, but you get the point, and that's all I'm saying. And it's in the privations that Louisa proves her love. Now, do you see it? It's in the bit that is really sacrificial for her. And one of the things that we need to do at some stage is put all the teaching on the privations together, and you'll be amazed at the amount of teaching on prayer it actually is. It's absolutely amazing. So I wanted to see whether you would continue your flights that means that you would go to the same level and pray in the same way without the same help. Okay. So without appearing to have the same help, excuse me. On hearing this, I said, ah, how could I continue without you? I lack the light. And if I would start, I would not finish, because the one who was making everything present to me would make me do it for all, making me bind all the relations between the creator and creation. This was not with me. So without this obvious help, I wasn't able to do what I would do normally, which is get into deep prayer. And what the Lord is showing you is John 15:5, without me, you can do nothing. Okay, so put John 15:5 at the side. And you learn that rather quickly in aridity. My mind would swim in an empty space without seeing anybody. How could I do them? And Jesus said, your starting was doing, the very fact that you would try. Isn't that fantastic? Mm-hmm. And your sorrow for not being able to finish it was completing. Mm-hmm. Now, so it's merely a test or a trial, because I knew that what my prayer wasn't going to be like that forever. So it's a test. And he wants to see, would you do it? Would you stick it out when you've looked at your watch 10 times and it doesn't seem to be moving, you know? And the more the time went on, I had no thoughts in my head. I couldn't have produced a good thought if you had paid me. I couldn't even read a book, but he didn't want me to read anyway, because reading would have been an avoidance of the issue. So he said, and I love this, your starting was doing and your sorrow for being unable to finish was completing. I think that piece of information is necessary for all the times when you're not feeling well or everything has come in on top of you and there literally is no time and you would really like to do something and do it well, but you can't. It's impossible. It's to put your trust in him and trust him completely. With a little bit of testing, one is always more certain and sure, Jesus says. And besides, if not even my queen mother was spared, would you like to be exempted? Now, beside this whole piece, I want to give you 2 Corinthians 12:9-10. My power works best in weakness. And the thing one of the secrets we really need to touch is that when we're at our weakest, we're actually at our strongest and we don't realise it. No, she's all right in here. She'll be all right here. She'll be okay here. So 2 Corinthians 12:9-10. That's all right, no problem. Come right in. Then after some time he came back and he made himself seen inside of me in the middle of a circle. Now this circle is the divine will. And he was inviting souls to go up on it so as to let them walk on that circle. I went up on it never to descend again. That's the bit you underline. Yes. Other people go up and they slide back. And my lovable Jesus said, my daughter, this circle is my divine will, which embraces the great wheel of eternity. Okay, so give yourself a circle at the top of your page, divine will, the wheel of eternity. Okay. Everything that is inside this circle is nothing other than all that my humanity did in the divine will. So put Jesus in the middle of the circle. Everything that his humanity did in the divine will. Okay. In order to intercede or impetrate that my will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So inside of the divine will, you have everything that Jesus did on earth to call down the divine will on the earth. So you can see why we're being called up into it, to join him and enter into him and continue. Everything is prepared and done. Okay. There's nothing left but to open the doors and to make it known so that souls may take possession of it. Okay. When I came upon earth to redeem man, it was said of me that I would be the salvation and the ruin of many. There's a quotation. Anyone know what the quotation is from? Simeon. Yeah, Simeon. Luke 2, 34 to 35. It's Simeon. I just want to point that out because sometimes he actually quotes scripture and sometimes the scripture is embedded in it and you can't see it unless it's pointed out. That one is clear. The same will be said now, that this will of mine will be either of great sanctity, because my will is absolute sanctity, or the ruin of many. Oops. Why would it be the ruin of many? And that is that they walk away from it. So I have an NB beside that. C. While rotating upon this circle, it is necessary to look inside of it. So we're looking inside of the divine will, never outside. Why? Because you won't find anything outside. Because inside of it, there is light, knowledge, my strength, my act as help, attraction and life, so that souls may take the life of my will within themselves. So we enter into that circle of the divine will and we can take whatever Jesus has prepared for us. Because you have that in your little booklet anyway. Enter into him, take what is there, make it your own in the divine will. Okay, so outside of the divine will, there's none of this. Souls will find outside darkness and they will fall into the abyss. Because outside is going to be the human will, isn't it? Therefore, be attentive and keep your gaze always fixed on my will. Okay, so if everything inside of your circle is divine will, then outside of it is the human will. Everything inside of it is light, outside of it is darkness. Now, I find as I go on in the volumes that making a small little diagram at the top of the page actually summarizes the whole thing. It's just a small little diagram for yourself. So that's why we have to keep our eyes on the divine will and on Jesus, because otherwise we will slip back to the human will. And he said, you will fall into the abyss. Because in the teaching on the human will, he says, it's not on this message, it's in another volume, he says that the human will is the prison of the soul. It keeps you out of salvation and out of darkness and everything. Therefore, be attentive. Keep your gaze always fixed into my will. Now, if you ask a pilot, how will he reach his destination? He'll say, because his compass is fixed on the destination. And if our compass is fixed on the destination, we will be able to get there as well. And you will find yourself with the fullness of the grace of living in the divine will. Now, the bit that I would underline for me is fullness. That you haven't just tasted the divine will and gone off and said, well, that's nice. But that you actually reach in to receive all that the Lord has prepared for us. Okay. Now, on October the 4th, 1923, we're still talking about the divine will. And here we're told that the divine will is everywhere, but it's not everywhere as life. Is that okay? It's there because we're created. So Louisa said, I felt myself being destroyed by the pain of his privation with the sad thought that he would no longer come to me. She keeps on going back to that. How piercing it was to think that I would not again see the one who forms the whole of my life, my happiness and all of my good. Now, while I was thinking of this, my sweet Jesus moved in my interior and told me, my daughter, how can I leave you if my will is imprisoned in your soul? Now, I like the word imprisoned there for the simple reason that I told you a moment ago, that the human will is the prison of the soul. But if the Lord imprisons his divine will, we are going to a wonderful place. Okay. And because my will is imprisoned in your soul, it gives life to all of your acts. Therefore, all of the acts are on the divine level. The divine will carries out its life as within its own center. So we become the tabernacle. So at one point of the earth, my life is there. It says there is my life because it's a poor translation from the Italian. If this life of mine were not there on the earth, my justice would pour itself out with such fury as to annihilate it. Now put a little NB beside that, because the more of us who try to live in the divine will and try to live in it 24/7, 365, the more points the divine will has on the earth, and therefore the more mercy will be shown to the people of the earth today and how much they need it. On hearing this, Louisa said, "My Jesus, your will is everywhere. Naturally, that's Psalm 139. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your face? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I go into the depths of Sheol, you are there. And even darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day." That's Psalm 139. So she said, "Your will is everywhere. And there's not one point at which it is not present, because otherwise it wouldn't exist. And you are saying that it's imprisoned in me." And Jesus said, "It is indeed everywhere with its immensity, with its all-seeingness, and with its power, that is, as creator. Like a queen, it subjects everything to itself, letting no one escape its empire. But as life," now I add the words "the source of life," "but as the source of life in which the creature forms her life," that means the origin of all your thoughts, words, deeds, movements and everything, "to carry out her life in the life of my will and to form the life of the divine will on earth." No, it doesn't exist. So it's present to keep everything in existence and to keep everything moving and all the rest of it, but to be the actual source that you've allowed it to be, the very source of your life, that is the privilege of people living in the divine will. For many who do not do the divine will, and it is many, it is as if my will didn't exist. And they're not even interested. It's the same as if someone had water in his room and didn't drink it, or fire and he wouldn't go near it in order to get warm, or bread and he wouldn't eat it, in spite of the fact that he has within himself these elements which can give life to man. By not taking them, he can die of thirst or cold or hunger. Others take them rarely, and so they're weak and ill. Others take them every day, and these are healthy and robust. Therefore, when one possesses a good, everything is in whether the human will wants to take that good and how it wants to take it. So, translating that a little bit, it's not just recognizing that the gift of the divine will is on offer to us. It's not even reaching out to say, "Yes, I want to receive it." It's in how you actually use it. Okay, it's what you actually do with it. And according to how one makes use of it, so does he receive its effects. So there's the operating in the divine will. Okay. "So it is with my will. In order for it to become the life of the soul must make her will disappear in mine." He's been saying that for 16 volumes. "Not my will, but thine be done." Her will must no longer exist. Now, that is the greatest gift that we can give to God. It's also the most difficult one. And we can give it now and discover in a half an hour that we took it back. Okay. And so the difficulty is to keep on surrendering until it is given. And he says when it is finally given, there's nothing else he can ask, because that's our great gift to give to him. "My will, as the primary act, must take over all of her acts." Now, you see, I said source of life back in the last paragraph, and he's giving it in another way now, as the primary act must take over all of her acts. "And it will give itself to the soul now as water to quench her thirst with its divine and celestial waters, another time as fire, not only to warm her, but to destroy what is human and to rebuild the life of my will inside of her. Sometimes it will be given as food to nourish her and to render her strong and robust. Oh, how difficult it is to find a creature who would surrender all her writes, the little word all is the problem. And to give my will alone the right to reign. And it's at that point that you can sing what people have been singing in charismatic prayer groups for youngs. He is Lord. We sing it, but we don't let it happen. And we let it happen every time we hand it over. So I want to give you two scriptures, Paul handing everything over. Philippians chapter 3, verses 8 to 16. I no longer want the life I had. I only want what comes from the Lord. That's my summing up of those verses. And I want to give you Galatians 2, 19 to 20. Now, it's when you read them, you'll see that Paul has reached the point of actually handing himself over lock, stock and barrel. And Jesus says that's the point of real happiness for us.
Is this the point of us consecrating ourselves to the divine will, or is that another point of creation?
I'll answer questions later.
Sorry.
Yeah. but write it down.
Yeah, okay.
So almost all want to keep something of their own will. It's that little something is the problem. And therefore, not reigning in them completely, my will cannot form its life in all creatures. Now, it's the little bit we hold back. And sometimes it is only a little thing. It might be that you're hanging on to an opinion that you have formed about something and you just won't let it go. And the amazing thing is, that St. John of the Cross says that if a bird is tied to a tree and it cannot fly, does it matter whether it's tied with a rope or a thread? And of course, the answer initially is no. But it's very much more tragic if it's tied with a thread. And very often it's the thread that keeps us back, not the big thing. We can face the big thing. The thread is harder to look at, like I'm hanging on to this thing. Maybe other people can see it, but I can't see it. Do you know what I mean? Or you're holding on to a tiny bit of resentment. Now, you think it's all gone, it's all done and dusted, and it's all healed and everything. But if there's a tiny bit there, it'll come back in the night and it'll just haunt you, that little tiny bit. And so thoughts that come to you in the night need to be heard. Because that's the Lord reminding you at a time when your mind is clear and there's no distractions. And it's a time of real grace. So it's hanging on to some little thing. So October the 16th, 1923. Let me give you an example of hanging on to something, a little thing. I was giving a talk one time and I was talking about Jesus cleansing the temple. And I said, as part of my discussion on the thing, I said, I love to see Jesus cleansing the temple and to see this masculine thing, you know, and he makes this and he absolutely sets up this chaos in the temple. Well, there was a lady absolutely enraged by my reaction, and she said, that's not my Jesus. And I said, what's your Jesus? She said, my Jesus is the Good Shepherd. So she had this absolutely still image. And I said, I have bad news for you. He never was a shepherd. It's only an image. But I said, what I'm describing in the temple actually happened. He was a real man and he was angry that they were destroying his father's house. And he took the only thing he had, which was a cord, and made knots out of it. And the animals would respond, the human beings wouldn't. And I said, it proves the incarnation, that Jesus is a real man. Don't stick to an image on a piece of paper. So she had this holy picture in her prayer group, you see, and Jesus was the Good Shepherd and he holding the little, and I'm the little lamb, of course. That means there will be no trials, no carrying of any cross or anything. Do you see where you can put an image inside of yourself and it's static, there will be no growth. And the thing the Lord used me for is to disturb the poor girl terribly. But then she might accept the real Jesus. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes it's something small like that. I mean, how small can it get if it's just a holy picture? You know. So I say that because people say, well, I don't know what it is I'm holding back. October the 16th, 1923, divine will versus human will, the big battle. The pain of the privation of my Jesus, Louisa says, concentrates more inside of my heart. So as she goes on with these privations, what comes to my mind is the Book of Lamentations, because the Book of Lamentations is a wonderful description of a people who have lost their Lord, and they've lost their temple, they've lost their privileges, they've lost everything, and that's what she's lamenting. So sometime in reading this, look up the Book of Lamentations. How long the nights are without him, she said. They seem to be eternal nights without Jesus, without stars and without sun. That means without light and without comfort, without anything. The only thing left to me is his lovable will. Now notice she's looking at the divine will with love, in which I abandon myself and I find my rest in the thick darkness that surrounds me. Now, beside that, I want to put Psalm 88, verse 18. Now, Psalm 88 is not one you'd expect, because it's talking about a person experiencing himself dying. And he says, my only friend is darkness. And when I explain that psalm to anybody, I say, and you don't realize he lived long enough to write the poem. He obviously came out of it. He didn't actually die. Jesus, Jesus, come to my tormented heart. I cannot go on without you. So that lament is the lament of a lover, and tells you the depth of love that Louisa has for Jesus. Now, while I was swimming in the immense sea of the pain of his privation, my Jesus moved in my interior, and taking my hands in his, he pressed them tightly to his heart, and he said to me, my daughter, so my will may descend upon the earth, it is necessary that your will rise up to heaven. Now notice Jacob's ladder there. The angels of God ascending and descending. That's John 1:51. So that the divine will can descend, a human will must go up to heaven. And so that it may rise up to heaven and live in the celestial fatherland, it is necessary to empty it of all that is human. That's the bit, that's the stripping we find most difficult. There are certain things that we don't really find all that difficult to give up, but the stripping of the human will, yeah. All that is human, all that is not holy, all that is not pure and upright. Nothing enters into heaven to live common life with us if it's not completely divinized. Now, you'd need to colour that in green, white and gold, because this is the struggle we have, and why we have to be purified all the time, all the time, all the time. So beside that, you can't enter heaven unless you're completely divinized. Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. Matthew 5:8, only the pure in heart see God. And Revelation 21:27. There's also a text in Isaiah 35. It's probably around verse 8. That only the redeemed can walk on this journey. Okay, so you can't enter heaven unless it's completely divinized and transformed completely into ourselves. That is the reason for purgatory. Because Jesus tells us in higher volumes that 9 out of 10 people go to purgatory. Nor can my divine will descend upon the earth to carry out its life as within its own center, if it does not find a human will emptied of everything, so that the divine will can actually take over, so as to fill it with the goods which my will contains. So that's like saying, I have this glass. If I want to fill it with water, whatever that's in it has got to go. Because otherwise it won't be filled with water. And the divine will can't mix with anything human. It will be nothing other than a most thin veil, which will serve me to cover myself and dwell inside of it, almost like a consecrated host. Now, there's your living hosts. Okay. And so we become the accidents of hiding the divine presence. So it will be nothing other than a most thin veil, which will serve me to cover myself and to dwell inside of it, almost like a consecrated host, in which I form my life. I do all the good I want. I pray, I suffer, I enjoy. That means the Lord continues his life in us. And it's important for us to sort of get the understanding that he wants to live his life in me and through me. I always remember it every morning. Most mornings I'm reading at Mass and I say, Lord, is nobody else going to stand up and read? It's you and me. No, it's you. And I say, you proclaim the gospel to them. Here's my mouth. And when you are conscious of it, it makes a big difference. And I just try to make myself conscious in certain actions. So you're almost like a consecrated host, which I form my life and I do all the good I want. I pray, I suffer, and I enjoy. So he prays in your prayers, suffers in your sufferings. Isn't that wonderful? And the host does not oppose. You see, that's what he tells us about the consecrated host at Mass, that the bread cannot oppose his divine will. And for us to be a living host, it has to be that the will in me will not oppose him in any way. It leaves me free. Its office is to be there to keep me hidden and to comply in mute silence to preserve my sacramental life. Just as the bread in the Eucharistic host is a silent holder of the divine presence. Try and picture yourself sitting in a crowd of people. You're living in the divine will. And there is the Lord present to that whole crowd because he's in you. And he is working in them because of you and through you. So he will look at them through your eyes and he will speak to them through your mouth and he will smile at them. Sometimes you can only smile at people. But it will be his smile and they'll recognize there was something special about the smile. They mightn't register that now with a lot of consciousness, but it will affect them. And it's beautiful if we just sort of remind ourselves of it. I love that. The host does not oppose. It leaves me free. Its office is to be there to keep me hidden and to comply in mute silence to preserve my sacramental life. This is the point we are at, he said to Louisa. Okay, that's the we, that's Louisa and Jesus. Your will is entering heaven and mine is descending upon the earth. Therefore, yours will no longer have life. It must have no reason to exist. The same happened to my humanity. Though it had a human will, this will was all intent on giving life to the divine will. It never arbitrated itself, not even to breathe on its own. But its breath also it would take and give to the divine will. And this is why the eternal will reigned in my humanity on earth as it does in heaven. Now, Jesus has explained that little bit that's so essential to the whole divine will thing. How does the divine will reign on earth as it is in heaven? He said, and I'm going to go back over these two sentences. The same happened to my humanity. It had a human will, but this will was all intent on giving life to the divine will. It never arbitrated itself, not even to breathe on its own, but its breath also it would take only with the divine will. And this is why the eternal will reigned in my humanity on earth as it does in heaven. So there you're being told what it is that we have to do to let that divine will reign on earth through us. It lived its terrestrial life in it. Now, the translation is very strange because you get all these its. The divine will lived its terrestrial life in the will of Jesus. Because otherwise that doesn't make sense. In my human will, fully sacrificed to the divine. Now notice the fully sacrificed. That is what he's been talking about, the complete surrender of the will. It impetrated that at the appropriate time, the divine would descend upon the earth to live in the midst of creatures, just as it does in heaven. So Jesus was interceding all the time that this would happen for all the rest of us. Don't you want to give my will its first place? That means that she's the first to, after Jesus and Mary, to live the divine will. Okay? So, right, first after Jesus and Mary, in case you forget. Now, while he was saying this, I seemed to find myself in heaven, Louisa said, and as though from one single point I could see all generations. Now, here's a very important point. You were told in the last message that the divine will was a circle. OK, now you're being told it's a single point. And once you know it's a single point, you will understand why there's no past or future. Everything's present in that single point. And whatever you pray for in the divine will covers absolutely everything instantly. OK, as if you yourself were back at the beginning and you yourself were forward in the future generations. Isn't it incredible? Mm-hmm. But I find it much easier to remember when you just realize that it is a single point. OK, it might help. I may have said this to you before, that the astrophysicists have now reached the point. They've gone way back from the Big Bang. You know that, because they realized someone needed a match for the Big Bang. And so they've gone back much further than that to what they call a singularity. One single point. And unfortunately, I'm talking to the television and I say, listen, that's called the divine will. Mm-hmm. But they've actually gone back to that just using their scientific language, which I find absolutely fascinating. So this singularity is what makes everything possible and everything simple in the divine will. Everything is simple. It's very difficult to have a problem in a single point. I could see all generations, she said, from the beginning to the end. And prostrating myself before the Supreme Majesty, I took the reciprocal love of the three divine persons, their perfect adoration, sanctity, always one, of their will, and I offered them in the name of all as a requital of love, adoration, submission, and union, which every creature should give to their creator. And that's something now we have to do. Okay. It's very easy. If I take a bucket of water and see my garden as only one point, it's very easy to water everything. But if I see it as 102 points, then I see it as a huge labor. And so prayers in the divine will are very simple. All you need is the vision. You just need the vision to know what you're actually doing. Louisa said, I wanted to unite heaven and earth, creator and creature, that they might embrace and exchange the kiss of the union of their wills. And so in the divine will, you pray that for them. So the prayer is actually done for them. The intercession is done. Now, Jesus did the intercession, Mary did the intercession, Louisa did the intercession, and we have to do it. Why? We have to put our drop of water in the wine. It's symbolized at Mass. Our participation is the drop of water in the wine. The consecration is done by the priest. Okay. And so that's why we have to participate. And my Jesus said, this is your task. To live in our midst and to make all that is ours your own and to give it to us on behalf of your brothers. So it's like someone I love is sick, and there's a whole lot of things you will do for that person when they cannot do it for themselves. So people in the divine will are doing all this stuff for their sick brothers and sisters spiritually, who cannot do it for themselves. They don't even know about it. And so you just do it for them. And it's part of the family. It's part of being family. It's part of being love. And it's part of being that whole wonderful structure of the divine order of God. So you do it on behalf of your brothers. Brothers means all human beings. So that, drawn by what is ours, we may be bound to the human generations and give them once again the supreme kiss of the union of their will and ours, which we gave to them at creation. So we have to enter into this intercession for the final healing of the human race. Okay. So October the 20th, 1923. The soul is the field in which Jesus works, sows and harvests. Louisa said, I felt all annihilated within myself. His privations cast me into the most profound humiliation because she's not able to do anything. Without Jesus, I feel the interior of my soul devastated. That's your John 15:5 again. It seems to me that all the good declines and dies. My Jesus, she said, how hard is your privation. And how my heart bleeds in seeing everything dying in me because the one who is life and who alone can give me life is not with me. And then while I was in this state, my most sweet Jesus came out from within my interior. What did he say in Luke 17:21? The kingdom of God is within you. Luke 17:21. He's there all the time. If God departed from us, we would simply disintegrate. He came out from within my interior and placing his hand upon my heart, pressing it strongly, he said to me, my daughter, why do you afflict yourself so much? Abandon yourself in me and let me do. Now, that's one of the biggest things we have to be told in the divine will. Just abandon yourself. We don't understand half the time. We don't even realize half the time what he's doing in us or what he wants to do in us. Abandon yourself and let him do it. And just make sure you tell him, you have my permission to do what you want. And if I resist you, will you push the resistance aside? Because I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in the resistance. I want to give you this. And the more we tell him, the more we will be actually able to give it to him. So abandon yourself in me and let me do. And when it seems to you that everything declines and dies, your Jesus will make everything rise again. So the whole experience is death and resurrection. Because rising to live in divine will is the resurrection. It is, in fact, the first resurrection, because you're living the same as the saints in heaven. But it's even more beautiful and more fertile. You must know that the soul is my field in which I work, in which I sow and harvest. But my favourite field is the soul who lives in my divine will. Now, you put beside that Ephesians 2:10, you are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. In this field, my work is delightful. I do not get muddy when I sow because my will has converted it into a field of light. Now, God is light, 1 John 1:5. And so anything he's allowed to touch, he makes it more and more into light. Now, as you go into the higher volumes, I mean over volume 20, you begin to see that Louisa is lighter and lighter and lighter, and she's more and more full of light. And you'll hear her saying with amazement, it's all light. It's all light. So that's the transformation. Because you remember the moment on Mount Tabor when Jesus was transformed into light. He was trying to give the apostles a first inkling of what life in heaven was like. That we're all transformed into light and love. Because that's what God is. So my favourite field is to sow in a soul that lives in my will, because there's going to be very little opposition there. In this field, my work is delightful. I don't get muddy and everything is converted into light. Its ground is virgin, pure and celestial. Now, when the Lord starts out with us, our souls may not be virgin, pure and celestial. They may be the exact opposite. But it's not where you come from that is important. It's where you're going. It's absolutely not where you're coming from. It's where you're going. We saw this in the most delightful way when we went to France, and Mary of Magdala was literally transformed into a seraph, with the angels lifting her up to heaven seven times a day. It's absolutely incredible. And her body incorrupt in the end. Absolutely incredible. So it's not where you come from, it's where you're going. We also met Sidonia. The man who was born blind, John chapter 9. So he starts out an absolute wreck. And then we saw a statue of him as a bishop, the second bishop of this area where Mary of Magdala lived. And I thought, yeah, I love this. This is pure gospel. This is the transformation. Like, nobody would have associated that thing that we were looking at, and his bones preserved as well, with the story in the gospel. You would presume he went back to his begging, you know. Not this incredible transformation. And so what the Lord gives to somebody who truly serves him is what the saints and the scholars have said ever since the beginning. He gives you a virgin soul. In other words, he brings you to the point where you start all over again. I'll talk to you more about that up in Drumantine. Makes the person pure and celestial. That's heavenly. So it's the heavenly life that operates in this person. And he said, I enjoy myself very much in sowing little lights into it. Now, right from the very beginning, the church has called progress in prayer enlightenment. That means receiving more spiritual light, more understanding, more wisdom, more everything. Almost like dew which forms the sun of my will. Oh, how beautiful it is to see the field of the soul all covered with many drops of light. Now, that's like looking out into the night and your garden is covered with all these little lights. And it makes it very pretty. Or if you're arriving by air at night and you see a whole city, and you see it's just like fairyland. That's what he's saying, that the soul in this condition looks like that to him. Very attractive. And as they gradually grow, many suns will form. Notice you start with drops of light and you end with suns. That's an amazing transformation to go from one to the other. Okay. And he says that from heaven, the sight is enchanting. All heaven is enraptured at the sight of it, and they're all attentive and looking at the celestial farmer who cultivates this field with so great mastery, and who possesses a seed so noble as to convert it into a son. So beside that, I want you to put Matthew 5, 14 and 16. Let your light shine so that others may see it and give glory to the Father who is in heaven. So if he converts it into a son, that means these little drops of light, which start off so small and so insignificant, eventually become a source of light for others. OK, that's the transformation. Now, to give you that in different words, I want to give you John chapter 7, verses 37 to 39. He said, if you are thirsty, come to me. And if you come, drink. And eventually out of your own heart will flow fountains of living water. So you become a source of life for others. So that's the little drops of light converted into the sun. Now, my daughter, this field is mine and I do with it whatever I want. But since God is creative and redemptive and sanctifying, that's what he does. Once these suns have been formed, I collect them. And I take them to heaven as the most beautiful conquest of my will. And then I return to the work of my field. In other words, he wants more. That's John 15 and verses 1 to 3, I think. that when you produce fruit, he comes back and he prunes you so he'll get more fruit. And then he looks for fruit that will last. And that's the eternal fruit. So this fruit that lasts is what he's looking for in the divine will. So I put everything upside down, he said, and the little daughter of my will feels everything ending, everything dying within her. In the place of the sun's so refulgent with light, she sees the drops of light which I am sowing, and she thinks that everything is perishing. How you deceive yourself. This is the new harvest that has been prepared. John 4, 35 to 38. Where the sower and the reaper will rejoice together. And since I want to make it more beautiful, which is your John 15, 2, I want more fruit, more beautiful than the previous one, and make it larger so as to be able to double my harvest, at first sight the work seems to be more difficult and the soul suffers more. But those pains are like strokes of the hoe in the ground. Now, it really would help when we have our little trials that we don't like, that we would just have a picture that the Lord is trying to sow something in me. Now, I'm a picture person, so the picture does it for me. You could give me 100 words and I wouldn't take them in. Just give me the picture and I have it. So if I'm going through a difficult moment and I think that Jesus is trying to get a new harvest out of me and he's got to dig up the furrows and sow it again, I say, that's okay. Then I know how to just offer him the pain with his pains and let him get on with it. And it just, it solves the problem for me anyway. So at first sight, the work seems to be more difficult and the soul suffers more. But those pains are little strokes of the hoe in the ground, which make the seed sink deeper, which is what he wants to get a greater harvest. So as to make it germinate more safely with greater fecundity and beauty. So don't you see, when a field is harvested, how squalid and poor it looks. But wait until it is sown again, and you will see it more flowery than before. So you'll notice that Jesus is never satisfied with what he has done in us. He's like a farmer. He wants better crops next year, since he got a decent crop this year. And therefore, it'll never be complete. It'll never, I was going to say completely comfortable. It'll never be comfortable because there's always too much happening. Therefore, he said, let me do it. Would you ever just let me do it? But you have to have this picture of him working in us to really be able to do that surrender. I know that other people say these wonderful surrender prayers and everything, but if I picture him just working, I say, oh, get on with it, it's all right. You know what you're doing. I don't have a clue and it doesn't matter. Because if I let you do it, then the harvest is going to be right. And you save yourself a lot of trouble. So he says to Louisa many times, just let me do it, let me do it. Now, why would he have to say that to Louisa at the height of relationship that she has? He tells her later on that he allows her to go through this because he has got to teach the generations coming after her. So all this teaching is for us. Louisa doesn't actually need it. Let me do, he said. And you, by living in my will always be at work with me. Okay. Now, at the end of the Song of Songs, I think I'm looking at chapter 7. It says, let us go into the vineyards and work. So we've enjoyed each other wonderfully. And all the rest of it. But the vineyards are out there and we need to produce a harvest. So there's work to be done. We will sow. Now notice we change from I to we. That's a very important thing. It's we, us. Because once you're in the divine will, you're doing it with him. We will sow the little drops of light together. And we will compete to see who sows the most. So we will enjoy ourselves in sowing or in resting, but always together. I know that your strongest concern, what your strongest concern is, that I won't leave you. No, he said, I can't leave you. One who lives in my will is inseparable from me. Now, this is the first time he actually says in these writings that Louisa is inseparable. Up to now, there was only one inseparable person. Who was that?
There.
That was his mother. Yeah. So he is now telling Louisa, and this is volume 16, that she has reached the goal. Isn't that amazing? That it's not the end of suffering, because she has got to do all of this suffering and everything to bring the divine will on the earth, just as Jesus had to go through unbelievable suffering to bring redemption to the earth. Okay. So Louisa said, "My Jesus, in the past you used to tell me that you would not come, and it was because you wanted to chastise the people. And now you say it's not because of this that you don't come, but because of something else." Now, I would imagine this is coming from the priests. Check this out, okay? And Jesus said, as though sighing, "They'll come, the chastisements will come. Oh, if only you knew," he said, "he disappeared." In other words, nothing has changed out there. The thing that has changed is what's happening between you and me. Okay. So as we go on, you see, what Jesus is doing with Louisa now is he's moved her away from just being a victim soul, okay, and he's moving her towards building a future full of hope for humanity in the era of the divine will, okay. And that future full of hope is Jeremiah 11:29. That's the future full of hope. Jeremiah 11:29. So I think I better stop here and give you a break before the next section. Okay. We'll just leave it there for tonight.